So turns out that as of February in the state of Alabama, I've got about the same rights as a freshly fertilized egg.
Yikes.
In case you missed it,
the Alabama Supreme Court has ruled that frozen embryos are children and that a person can be held liable for destroying them.
It could effectively end IVF in the entire state of Alabama.
The court cited Alabama's constitution in its ruling, saying even before birth, all human beings bear the image of God and their lives cannot be destroyed without effacing his glory.
The Alabama Supreme Court's recent ruling that all embryo lives matter is just the latest in a string of calculated moves by conservatives designed to chip away at our bodily autonomy since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. To date, 21 states have already enacted extreme abortion policies. This May, Florida will roll out its insane 6-week ban that, on top of the extremely short window to obtain an abortion, also requires 2 in-person doctor visits with a 24-hour waiting period in between, or official documentation proving the need for an exception for something like rape or incest, requiring people to find official documentation of their rape or incest case. But what's even more disturbing about this goes way beyond abortion into a larger conversation about privacy and which of our rights are still guaranteeable under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. The same clause that we've used to establish all sorts of essential protections, including the right to contraception, the right to engage in consensual sex with an adult of your choice regardless of their gender, the right not to be forcibly sterilized by the state, the right to marry someone of a different race or of the same sex. All of those decisions stretching back decades are now in peril. Today, I'm investigating the tactics, motivations, and key players behind the conservative push to exploit and undermine the 14th Amendment. What patterns does the Alabama IVF ruling reveal about how conservatives are working to unravel our liberties, reproductive and otherwise? How did we get here in the first place? How can we protect one another as conservatives move to exert ever more extreme control over citizens of the so-called land of the free? And what does an 1873 law regulating the mail have to do with any of it? Turns out that abortion was just the beginning. Roll the intro. Thank you to my partner on today's video, Magic Spoon. Y'all, I love cereal so much. But I'm also a 32-year-old lady, so too much sugar makes my body very angry, okay? We're talking tired, a little nauseous. It's a catch-22, but not with Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon is cereal reinvented. Magic Spoon cereal has zero sugar, simple ingredients, and extra protein to fuel you for breakfast or any meal or snack of the day. Really, let's be honest, if I could eat cereal for every meal and snack, I would. The Magic Spoon variety pack comes with 4 delicious nostalgic flavors: fruity, frosted, cocoa, and peanut butter. My favorite is to mix the chocolate and peanut butter together and then top that with almond milk. Forget about it, okay? It's so good. It has the same great taste that you remember, but upgraded with grown-up ingredients, including no artificial flavors or dyes. I buy Magic Spoon cereal with my own money, honey, so I was super excited to partner with them for this video. Click the link below to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use the promo code LEJA at checkout to get $5 off any order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee, so if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund your money, no questions asked. But like, I promise you are gonna be so happy. So click the link below and use code LEJA for $5 off, or go to magicspoon.com/LEJA to save $5 today. Thanks, Magic Spoon. So it's December 2020 at the Mobile Infirmary Medical Center in Mobile, Alabama. Under cover of what we can only assume was unprecedented chaos during the pandemic's first holiday season, an unnamed patient goes for a little wander through the halls of the medical center. The exploration leads to the hospital's fertility clinic, where our mystery patient somehow gains access to the cryogenic nursery where frozen embryos are stored. Here, he quickly learns that poking around sub-freezing scientific specimens is a great way to get your naked little fingies burned, causing our vigilante visitor to drop some of the vials containing fertilized eggs, destroying them. Or, I guess, killing them, as it turns out. This led to the IVF case ultimately decided by the Alabama Supreme Court this February. The plaintiffs, 3 couples, all of whom had already had healthy babies through IVF, just by the way, wanted to be compensated for the emotional distress that had resulted from the wrongful deaths of their embryonic children. By getting the embryos characterized as people instead of property, the plaintiffs suddenly found themselves entitled to much more money in the form of court-ordered damages. After their case was dismissed by the trial court, the couples appealed all the way up to the Supreme Supreme Court of Alabama, which found that under the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, the couples were entitled to compensation because, according to the court, the act applies to all unborn children without limitation, and that includes unborn children who are not located in utero at the time they are killed. Within a week of the ruling, multiple IVF clinics had paused all services, terrified of the catastrophic levels of liability they suddenly found themselves exposed to. Think about it. If any medical professional who accidentally damages or destroys a microscopic embryo can be on the hook for millions of dollars in damages because those cells have full personhood under the law, who could afford to risk it? And IVF is already expensive. It can cost up to $30,000 for a single cycle. But for thousands of families, it's a price worth paying. In 2021 alone, IVF helped bring 86,000 American babies into the world. That's 2.3% of all our babies that year conceived through IVF. At a point in American history where educated people are waiting longer than ever to have kids, the maternal mortality rate is higher than in any other so-called developed country on Earth, and science has empowered us to prevent debilitating genetic mutations from being passed down, it makes sense why IVF is so popular. But popularity doesn't guarantee protection, as we saw when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade despite a majority of Americans supporting legal abortions. So the fact that 86% of Americans surveyed in a recent CBS News YouGov poll said IVF should be legal isn't all that reassuring. Such data did pair nicely with the swift national backlash, prompting the Alabama governor to quickly pass a law carving out an exception designed to let IVF clinics get back to work. But it's a stopgap, not a long-term solution. By deciding that the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act applies to all unborn children, regardless of their location, the Alabama Supreme Court put embryos into the same category as fetuses, which were already protected under the Sanctity of Life clause in the state's constitution. Previously, this clause only applied to fetuses in utero or children who had been born, but the court said that this amounted to discrimination against full-term infants or toddlers conceived through IVF and gestated to term in an in vitro environment, because said children would both be unborn, meaning having never been delivered from a biological womb, and not in utero. The fact that experts estimate we're at least 5 years away from even being capable of fully gestating human life in a lab was immaterial, apparently. So what does this mean in practice? IVF, or any medical technology that deals with an already fertilized egg, including the abortion pill and some kinds of contraception, will need ironclad protections to stay legal, at least in Alabama. The ruling that embryos, regardless of location, are people could have the effect of banning all these methods without explicitly outlawing any of them. Typically, IVF involves harvesting and fertilizing batches of eggs, then testing to ensure they're good candidates to become thriving, viable humans. The top candidates are then implanted in the uterus to see what sticks. This is the most economically and emotionally efficient version of a grueling scientific process refined over decades. However, under new definitions, providers could be forced to harvest, fertilize, and implant one sample at a time, because the loss of any technically fertilized egg, even non-viable ones, could lead to a wrongful death lawsuit. Not only would this make costs explode, but efficacy would plummet. According to research by Reproductive Medicine Associates, implanting three viable embryos results in a 95% chance of a successful pregnancy, compared to a 65% success rate with one embryo. And on top of all of that, there's the question of what to do with bad eggs. Rather than discarding or studying any embryos deemed unviable or otherwise undesirable, clinics could be legally responsible for preserving them indefinitely, meaning they'd have to foot the bill to maintain giant sub-zero freezers regardless of the patient's wishes or financial contributions. And that's simply an untenable business model. Whichever way you slice it, everyone involved is likely to waste a lot of time, money, and emotional bandwidth protecting suboptimal zygotes. But this approach would be so much simpler and closer to the way that God intended things, you know? Genetic testing in IVF is just an insult to the will of God. And if anyone should be concerned with the will of God, it's definitely judges, lawmakers, and the government. And yeah, I'm exaggerating slightly with that language, but not by much. Check out this letter that a coalition of pro-life organizations sent to Alabama's governor, urging her to veto the IVF-preserving carve-out legislation. Legislation meant to allow IVF clinics to continue functioning. Governor Ivey, it is an indisputable scientific fact that human life begins at the moment of fertilization. The moment of fertilization, when an individual human zygote is formed, marks the starting point of each human being's life. The embryonic period is simply one stage of development in the life of a human being, just like the fetal, childhood, adolescent, and adult stages of life. IVF is not a morally neutral issue, and it would be a grave mistake to rush through any legislation without seriously considering the ethical questions and very real consequences of leaving a procedure as consequential as creating human life unregulated. It's not unregulated, it's a medical procedure, but okay. We urge you to veto this legislation as a rash reaction to a troubling situation. While we understand and share the legislators' concern for families struggling with infertility, this unjust measure will ultimately harm these families and jeopardize the lives of precious children. Or in other words, sorry not sorry to everyone we're harming with this, you'll thank us later. Classic paternalism. The good news is that Governor Ivey chose not to heed this impassioned plea and signed the IVF exception into law anyway, a move that would turn out to toe the party line when a few weeks later Trump announced his latest position on reproductive rights and made me never want to hear the words precious baby again.
I strongly support the availability of IVF for couples who are trying to have a precious baby. What could be more beautiful or better than that? Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights. The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections to restore our culture and, in fact, to save our country, which is currently, and very sadly, a nation in decline.
By throwing it back to the states, Trump is distancing himself from the more heinous laws getting passed in places like Florida and Arizona without actually condemning them. He's also saying the quiet part out loud. In order to win national elections, we can't actually be supporting these abortion bans at a federal level because the vast majority of Americans believe people should have access to abortion. He's literally acknowledging that this push for abortion bans, IVF bans, and everything that comes after is coming from a very small faction of lawmakers and not in line with what the majority of Americans want. I mean, conservatives all know that anyway, but this is the first time it's been acknowledged that that's what's happening. Biden, however, did come right out and condemn these state laws. Well, his office did, issuing a statement that called Arizona's recently resurrected 1864 abortion ban, which doesn't offer exceptions for cases involving rape or incest, cruel and a result of the extreme agenda of Republican elected officials who are committed to ripping away women's freedom. It's not what I'd call a hot take, but it's probably better than nothing, which, as usual, is what Congress has managed to accomplish. Senator Tammy Duckworth, a military vet who used in vitro fertilization to conceive both of her daughters, has been a vocal co-sponsor of the Access to Family Building Act, an attempt to enshrine protections for IVF federally. But despite gathering support from fellow Democrats, no one from the other side of the aisle has been willing to get on board, and the bill has been languishing in committee for months, where it will likely die.
And by the way, this isn't just about access to reproductive technology. This is also about contraception. Remember that an IUD prevents implantation of fertilized egg. In Illinois, we're already getting women traveling to Illinois from as far away as Texas to have an IUD implanted because their doctors back in Texas are afraid that they could be prosecuted.
We're seeing the same thing in Minnesota. As a longstanding pro-choice state surrounded by states enacting stricter and stricter abortion laws, we've seen an influx of abortion refugees since the overturn of Roe. But with this IVF ruling in Alabama, we see the next wave of laws meant not only to limit the number of weeks during which a person can seek an abortion. These laws go further to try to control every step of the process and limit any and all personal autonomy over our uteruses. Next up, the abortion pill, which now amounts for more than half of all U.S. abortions. On March 26, 2024, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. The plaintiffs were a cohort of anti-abortion doctors and organizations representing anti-abortion doctors who claim that patients should not be able to self-administer the synthetic steroid mifepristone, Miffy as some people call it. Mifepristone is often, though not exclusively, used to induce abortions. When taken in combination with a second medication, misoprostol, pregnancy is ended in 95% of patients. The remaining 5% need some kind of surgical intervention to complete the procedure. Severe complications from the drug are rare, and according to Dr. Elizabeth Raymond, an OBGYN and scientist at the global reproductive health organization Genuity, mifepristone is simply not medically controversial at all. So what exactly are the Alliance doctors upset about? Well, they're mad about mifepristone's statistically insignificant potential to injure them morally at an entirely theoretical point in the future. And if you're like, wait, is that even allowed? Nope. Or it shouldn't be. Purge is generally accepted and precedent-established rules about standing, meaning your ability to bring a case in the first place. You're generally not supposed to be able to bring lawsuits about hypothetical situations in which you personally haven't actually been injured yet. When mifepristone was approved for abortions by the FDA in 2000, the drug had already been used successfully by women in France for a dozen years. In 2013, a report reviewing the results of 87 studies leveraging data from more than 45,000 people who'd used mifepristone for medical abortions found that less than 5% of patients needed surgical interventions to complete the abortion after taking the drug. The report also showed that serious side effects, symptoms severe enough to require hospitalization, were uncommon, occurring in only 3 out of every 1,000 patients. So 5% of patients require a surgical follow-up, but only 0.3% come through the ER, where the complaining doctors claim to be in imminent danger of moral compromise. The case currently before the Supreme Court is two cases consolidated into one. The first is about the Food and Drug Administration, whether the FDA's actions to loosen regulations on mifepristone in 2016 and 2021 were arbitrary and capricious, and whether the respondents have standing to challenge the FDA on this at all. According to the defense, this is the first time any court has questioned the FDA's judgment about access to a drug, and this arbitrary and capricious language comes from long-established precedent called the Chevron Doctrine, in which judges tend to give broad deference to the decisions of agencies like the FDA, the idea being that the FDA, filled with experts with years of experience in the field, is in a much better position to make decisions and regulations than a panel of judges with no expertise. This applies not just to the FDA, but also to all government agencies, and a ruling here by the Supreme Court that the FDA was being arbitrary and capricious would hack away at that Chevron deference, giving the court more and more leeway to question and do away with agency-made regulations, something this Supreme Court and conservatives around the country have been gunning for. Hence, there's been a lot of commotion about what a ruling in the plaintiff's favor would mean for the FDA and the continued validity of any other decisions resulting from its rigorous gold standard review process. At one point, Justice Jackson asked if judges were even qualified to second-guess the FDA since they were not experts in statistics and so much of this came down to analyzing data. The lawyer for the FDA responded by saying that they are not.
FDA has many hundreds of pages of analysis in the record of what the scientific data showed. And courts are just not in a position to parse through and second-guess that.
The second defendant is the drug company Danko Laboratories, which only makes mifepristone. And the big question there is whether an association has standing to stop a government action by arguing that some unspecified member may be injured at some future point in time by the challenged action. As we already discussed, it shouldn't. But it might. How did this unhinged and seemingly unfounded lawsuit make it to the Supreme Court? Well, may I introduce this fucking guy. Trump-appointed District Court Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, beloved rubber stamp for litigants on the radical right. Until recently, 95% of civil cases filed in Amarillo, Texas's federal courthouse were automatically assigned to Kaczmarek, which made it easy for him to connect with any conservative interest group looking for a sympathetic court to block whatever federal policy they found troublesome. Since being appointed by Trump in 2019, Kaczmarek has become as well-known for his bigoted ideology as for his poorly reasoned legal arguments. According to Senator Chuck Schumer, the level of hostility Kaczmarek has demonstrated towards the LGBTQ community borders on paranoia. For instance, his ruling in Nice v. Becerra found that federal law prohibiting certain forms of discrimination by health providers does not protect against LGBTQ discrimination. This despite clear and direct U.S. Supreme Court precedent that says the opposite. Not once but twice, Kaczmarek attempted to compel the Biden administration to reinstate the harsh Trump-era Remain in Mexico border policy, claiming that eliminating it violates a 1996 federal immigration law. It doesn't, which the Supreme Court made clear the first time they overturned his decision in 2022. Legal scholars have called Kaczmarek's ruling an embarrassing misreading of the law, which seems to be this guy's thing. In the wake of the Dobbs decision, Kaczmarek jumped to become the first federal judge to attack the right to contraception. Jurisdiction be damned. His decision in DeAnda v. Becerra said it was unlawful for the federal program Title 10 to give grants to healthcare providers to fund family planning and contraceptive care because the grantees weren't required to get parental approval before treating underage patients. The plaintiff argued that because the availability of these services had the potential to undermine his desire to raise his daughters with a Christian, abstinence-based worldview, Title 10 violated his rights. The alleged harm was once again hypothetical. Neither the plaintiff nor his daughters had interacted with a Title 10 program ever. All this was known when he heard the case, but Kaczmarek was like, yeah, That sounds about right. And as one Vox reporter put it, Kaczmarek's decision is riddled with legal errors, some of them obvious enough to be spotted by a first-year law student. And it contradicts an agreement among federal courts that parents do not have a constitutional right to target government programs providing contraceptive care. Even so, the Fifth District Court of Appeals, which has a track record of supporting Kaczmarek's rulings, recently affirmed his decision. The audacity is incredible. But since this man has a lifetime appointment, thanks to Trump, we're just kind of stuck cleaning up his messes for the foreseeable future. Unless his ethical missteps eventually amount to enough to get him kicked off the bench, a notoriously difficult thing. Which is unfortunate considering the enthusiasm he and his conservative Christian cronies have for returning to the past. You may have noticed a theme in our investigation today. Long-standing precedents abandoned left and right while old laws are resurrected to wreak havoc on our modern lives. Arizona's recently resurrected draconian abortion law, the one that bans abortion in the case of rape or incest, is from 1864. Alabama's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act was passed in 1872. 1 year before Congress passed the Comstock Act, the law that Kaczmarek, encouraged by directives from Project 2025's mandate for leadership, invoked in the Mifepristone case. The Comstock Act is named for Anthony Comstock, founder of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and eventual United States Postal Inspector under President Grant. We talked about him in my video about book bans because this fucking guy generally hated the transport through mail of any obscene, lewd, or lascivious materials. And the things this guy considered obscene were generally pretty commonplace, even in the 1800s. Comstock considered any mention of abortion to be obscene, on par with pornography. So he got a law passed declaring non-mailable every article, instrument, substance, drugs, medicine, or thing which is advertised or described in a manner calculated to lead another to use it or apply it for producing abortion. The Comstock Act was long considered unenforceable, especially in light of myriad First Amendment rulings protecting even obscene speech. But then Project 2025 released its mandate for leadership and devoted an entire section to how we can and should resurrect the Comstock Act to ban abortion pills. And suddenly, this zombie is the most popular girl in school. At least on the right. And though Project 2025 focuses on the shipping of abortion pills, Comstock prohibits the mailing of anything used in abortions, meaning it has the potential to create the effect of a national abortion ban. You don't need to make abortion illegal if it's illegal to buy the tools you need to conduct an abortion, which are then sent through the mail. It's unclear why the pharmaceutical industry isn't freaking the fuck out about this. Still, potential blowback doesn't seem a massive concern for the people most committed to giving this Comstock argument a spin. In early 2023, 9 Republican senators wrote letters warning the heads of major pharmacy chains that if they continued distributing abortion pills, they could be liable under Comstock's 5-year statute of limitations if Trump got a second term. Both Justices Thomas and Alito mentioned Comstock during oral arguments in FDA v. Alliance. It's unclear where the court will land on the Comstock question. For the reasons we discussed earlier, it might not even come to that. There's still a chance that they'll dismiss the case for lack of standing. Meanwhile, Democratic legislators are trying to get the act repealed. Congresswoman Cori Bush took to Twitter calling for defensive action. A few days later, Minnesota Senator Tina Smith joined her with a New York Times op-ed outlining the importance of taking away Comstock as a tool to limit reproductive freedom. She says she's working to build a coalition behind the scenes while waiting to see what the Supreme Court decides in the Mifepristone case. But it might not be enough to combat the insanity coming from the radical right. As Matthew Taylor, a scholar at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, explains, these folks aren't as interested in democracy or working through democratic systems as in the old religious right, because their theology is one of Christian warfare. And who's better at Christian warfare than the Catholic Church? On April 8th, the Vatican released a 20-page declaration titled Infinite Dignity, clarifying Pope Francis's problematic positions on everything from gender fluidity to the exploitation of migrants, a reminder of just how intertwined these various fights are with religion. Per the New York Times, regarding surrogacy, the document unequivocally stated the Roman Catholic Church's opposition, whether the woman carrying a baby is coerced into it or chooses to subject herself to it freely. Surrogacy makes the child a mere means subservient to the arbitrary gain or desire of others, the Vatican said in the document, which also opposed in vitro fertilization. This document may seem like it came out of the left field in light of the multiple seemingly progressive moves this same pope has made in the last few months, like allowing transgender people to be baptized and to become godparents, and permitting same-sex couples to be blessed by priests. Now he's condemning IVF and surrogacy in favor of the inherently dignified and humane path of adoption. And this is a big part of what's so infuriating. This moralistic rhetoric from the pope and politicians alike is just a shield to avoid saying the choir part out loud, that they don't give a flying fuck about who gets hurt by their draconian policies, that small government was never the goal, but rather an expansion of government to the point of fascism, and that the morals and ethics that they cite to, as opposed to, you know, established law or court precedent, are entirely motivated by religious beliefs, beliefs they seek to impose on everyone nationwide. The goal is not to protect women. The goal is not to protect children. I've shown time and again in my videos that their policies actively hurt living, breathing, fully born children. And it's been shown time and again that access to abortion care is generally safe when legal and regulated, and protects the lives of people who are pregnant, because it's often far safer to get an abortion than to carry a child to term, for any number of reasons. And taken together, the radical right's slew of draconian policies, from wanting to do away with the Affordable Care Act, food stamps and other social programs, funding to public schools, and so much more, it's very clear, in the end, the types of babies that the radical right are actually concerned with saving. The white, wealthy ones. Dahlia Lithwick put it well in a recent Slate article. When Republicans insist that life begins at conception, and also that seven cell clusters constitute life, what they're saying, what they were always saying, is that we as a society need babies so badly that somebody should always be entitled to take control and custody over somebody else's baby, and indeed of every potential baby. Because your babies don't belong to you. They belong, variously, to God, to the GOP, to the state, and to those who want to raise them in your stead. Conservative Christians are emboldened by sympathetic courts who finally embrace their preferred reading of the rules. They watched with horror for more than half a century as morally bankrupt liberals used the 14th Amendment to protect all kinds of reprehensible forms of diversity. Activists who've been working to protect access to abortion and other progressive policies have been screaming for decades that this was coming.
I was correct.
That ever since Roe v. Wade came down in 1973, those on the right have been organizing and slowly chipping away not only at abortion access, but at all the rights we have obtained under the privacy protection of the 14th Amendment. But now, with Trump-appointed judges across the country and a Supreme Court emboldened by a conservative majority, the tides are finally turning for the Christian nationalists on the right. As Dahlia Lithwick puts it, in their opinions confirming the Dobbs decision, Alito pinky promised us that the holding was limited to abortion, and Justice Brett Kavanaugh wishcast that nobody would dream of restricting interstate travel. But these assurances were instantly undermined by Justice Clarence Thomas's pledge in his concurrence that the court could and should soon come for contraception, marriage equality, and whatever else had been protected under the long line of substantive due process cases. Dobbs was never self-limiting to abortion. It was a save-the-date card for the religious rights plan to come for the rest of our reproductive freedoms. So, yeah. Things are looking grim, and I wish I had something to present you with, like, look, see, we have lawmakers working on this, we have cases overturning this, but at least nationally, and in many, many states, we don't. And with lifetime appointments for judges across the country and on the Supreme Court, there isn't much hope for any of this changing for the better anytime soon. I'm sorry, I usually like to end these things on a positive note, but this is just a pretty grim situation. In these cases, what I try to turn to is mutual aid. We have each other, and we do have people on the ground in every state in the country either working to undo these laws, working to keep protections in place, or working to help people access abortion, IVF, and contraception in whatever way possible. You can help by donating, offering your time, or offering your resources, depending on the need in your area. To find information most efficiently, go to ineedana.com. This is a comprehensive resource for anyone seeking an abortion anywhere in the country. Enter your location to find out about resources in your area. For example, if you search Mobile, Alabama, you'll see that abortion is banned in Alabama, but there is a clinic 4 hours away that provides care. And if you scroll down, you can see under What If I Need Help Paying that Access Reproductive Care Southeast provides funding and resources. You can donate directly to them or look into other ways they suggest getting involved. In Minneapolis, I can see that there are two clinics within 15 minutes driving that offer abortion care. I can see how to get involved with those clinics, or if I click on What If I Need Help Paying, I can see that Midwest Access Coalition provides funding and resources. By going to their website, I can donate and see other ways to get involved. Providing access to safe reproductive care is now a mutual aid concern, because our government and our lawmakers have abandoned us in this process. By seeking out ways to provide time and resources to this cause, you can give back directly, which I find to be the only way to stay sane when it feels like everything is hopeless. Thank you to my Patreon community and my YouTube members for supporting the research and work that goes into these videos. If you're looking to get early access to ad-free, uncensored versions of my videos, or even to fun merch like this, consider checking out my Patreon community or clicking the big join button below to become a member here on YouTube. You'll be supporting my work and getting access to special extra content as well. The extra content is the same whether you join as a YouTube member or on Patreon. Your support helps to keep these videos free for everyone and further our mission towards legal and political education for all. Shout out to my newest supporters, as well as supporters in my royal tiers, and a very special shout out to my multi-platinum supporters, Latranger Lucas, Joshua Cole, Thomas Johnson, Sophia Sams, Anthony Giles, and Brett Piontek. Your generosity makes this channel what it is, so thank you. If you like this video, you'll also like my video about book bans and the far right. Thanks so much for watching. Have a good day. Bye-bye.